Parshas Tetzaveh, we'll just won't go through all the Pesukim in the second Aliyah, so that we can have some time to talk about Purim and related Inyanim. But I'll just highlight some of the themes, especially because it's not necessarily synergy in the second parak, but it's more of a symbolic synergy, because we find the Pasuk in the second Aliyah of Tetzaveh, in the beginning of the Aliyah, towards the beginning, Pasuk Tezvav, V'yasisa Choshen Mishpat. So that's basically what we're doing this year. We're doing Choshen Mishpat. So in a sense, there is at least a symbolic synergy in that sense. And of course, there's a lot to talk about in that sense. It's always a little bit of a fun pursuit to certain sections of the Torah and certain sections of Nach lend themselves more to this than others. But it's a little bit of a hobby to keep an eye out during the Aliyah and count how many Sfarim titles come up. So here in this one, you have quite a few. So yeah, Zot HaBracha definitely is a special source of titles. But here also, right at the very beginning, we have the Mishpat Zav. We know that's part of the Prima Gadim. And here we talk about Choshen Mishpat. There'll be a few others throughout the Parsha and throughout the Aliyah. But the Choshen Mishpat itself is a interesting concept, not just an interesting chelek of Shulchan Aruch, but an interesting concept. And it sounds like, from the way it's presented, and the way that Targum Yonason translates this pasuk, that we would ask it shailas in halacha. We'd ask it in terms of what to do. And that's a difficult point, as the Chemdes Yisrael, was written by the Kli Chemda, was one of the Talmidim of the Avnei Nezer, and others point out that we generally assume that we don't consult God on halachic matters. We say that lo b'shamayim hi, and the Gemara invokes that in Bava Metzia, most famously, in the context of Machlokas. But we also find, for example, the Gemara says in Tmura that many halachas were forgotten, and it was only because Othniel ben Knaz, who I always argue should be more a choice of a name among Lamdanim, because he's the hero of Lamdas. He was able to use his pilpul to restore the halachas that were forgotten during the days of Moshe Rabbeinu. And it seemed like that was the only way they could get it back. That otherwise we'd say, lo b'shamayim hi. So how come here you find that the Urim V'Tumim, that the Choshen Mishpat seems to be utilized on halachic matters? Is that really the case? So some want to suggest that maybe it depends. If the halacha is possible to be figured out on our own, even if it's a lot of effort, so then that's our job. But if we had some matter where we would not be able to figure it out on our own, so then the Choshen HaMishpat would have to help with that. The Sefer Ol Moshe, Moshe Scheinerman, he quotes a number of discussions about this, and he quote that the Torah Tamima sounds like maybe it's possible to use the Choshen Mishpat to restore halachas that were forgotten. Except that it sounds like the Gemara we just mentioned a minute ago from the Gemara in Torah, not that way. But on the other hand, it sounds from the Gemara in the beginning of Masechus Megillah, which we have to give cover to this week, that that might be possible, because the Gemara there talks about the din of Ein Novi Rishai L'Chadesh Davar, that normally we say that a Navi is not allowed to introduce new halachos, but there the Gemara says a Navi could come and restore something that was forgotten. So maybe the Urim V'Tumim could do the same thing, that if we have the halachos given to us and we don't remember it, maybe it's possible for it to accomplish that purpose. He also notes that maybe it's there to play a role in the halachic process in terms of it could evaluate hidden metzias. Now the Gemara says that in the context of the man, that the man was able to, the Gemara says in Yuma, that the man was able to tip Moshe off how to paskin in certain Dinei Torah. So for example, if somebody was fighting with somebody else over an Eved, one guy says, you stole the Eved from me, and the other guy says, no, I bought the Eved from you. So they would look to see where his man would turn up, where would his portion of the man show up the next morning. If it shows up in the tent of the original guy, you see that it was stolen from him. And if it shows up in the tent of the new guy, you see the new guy legitimately bought him. So sometimes you have this etzah, you have this help from Shamayim in terms of figuring out the elements of the case, but the psak was still left up to human beings. So maybe the Choshen HaMishpat played a role in that sense. It's also a question how it fits in terms of Mochama. The Ramban in his Hasagas to the Sefer HaMitzvahs, so he raises the question if it was used at all for Melchemes HaRishus. So as the Chemdes Yisrael also tries to figure out, so what are you telling me? Are you telling me that it's Davki used for Melchemes Mitzvah? So how does that work? If Melchemes Mitzvah is a mitzvah, so if you're going to ask the Urim Tumim yes or no, you already know it's yes or no. So in the Paris Yosef he discusses this, and what he wants to suggest is that maybe it's a similar kind of approach. It has to do with evaluating a certain element of the situation. For example, if you want to go to Milchama against Amalek or against the Zion Amun, so you may need some type of analysis whether it's a safe situation. Will you be Matzliach or will you not be Matzliach? He connects this to a comment to the Sefer Achinuch. The Sefer Achinuch says, so this gives a little bit of a kiyum in Zachar, that you have to wipe out a Amalek or the Zion Amun as long as you're not going to endanger yourself in doing so. So Menchas Chinuch asks on that, it's a famous Menchas Chinuch, is quoted in a lot of other contexts, that what does he mean as long as it's not a sakana? So a sakana gets you out of other mitzvahs, but it can't get you out of a mitzvah of Mochama. Mochama by definition is sakana, and yet it exists. So we know if there's a concept of Melchemes Mitzvah, which will always entail Sakana, so then you can't tell me that Sakana pates you from Melchama. So however you address the Menchas Chinuch's questions, the Paris Yosef says, you see, if you follow the Chinuch, that Sakana is an element. So maybe what the Ramban is saying is that even if it's a Melchemes Mitzvah, you'll use the Chosha Mishpat in order to assess if there is a Sakana. It was never totally fully understanding what the Menchas Chinuch was getting at, because there's a difference between sakana and basic Yehar Voyavor Pikuach Nefesh considerations. That yes, it's true that Mochama is always dangerous, so it's true that sakana doesn't pat you by its very nature from Mochama, but you still make cheshbonos within Mochama based on how to save the most lives and endanger the fewest lives. It's just unlike other areas of halacha where you could say if there's any sakana involved, the whole din is not going to apply. So clearly the threshold for Mochama is going to be different. But still, you don't undertake suicide missions. You're still making decisions in Mochama based on what the odds are going to favor the most. So to say that it's not a cheshbon at all in the context of Mochama, I'm not sure why you have to say it like that. So in any event, that's just in terms of the Chassidus question, so it makes sense to say really according to everybody that Sakana is part of the consideration in all Milchamas, even if it doesn't get you off the hook from the whole thing. And then maybe the Choshen Mishpat had a role to play in that context. Hi.
But with Minchas Chinuch, isn't it just saying that you have the sti of a Milchama no matter what, so you have to do it in a situation where there's going to be at least Sakana, like you're saying, but it doesn't change the fact that you have the chiyuv, so it's inherently part of the chiyuv of Mechama that you have a sakana. So even though you're trying to minimize it, it's still going to be some sakana.
The exact language of the Sefer HaChinuch, that if you can do it without sakana, that's what you're asking.
Like,
right, so it's a question of a threshold. The idea, it seems to be a little bit of a quantitative distinction. That to say that any sakana at all will get you out of Mechama, that doesn't make sense to say. But the fact that sakana is part of the equation, and this is invoked a lot in some of the considerations in Eretz Yisrael in terms of what types of negotiations, what types of issues are invoked. And it's sometimes mentioned that the Menchas Chinuch says there's no issue of pikuach nefesh or mochama. So it's a question if that's really what he means to say. He means to say that some understand that the difference is that mochama means you do a pikuach nefesh on the national level rather than on the individual level. So we don't look at individuals by themselves as much as we look at the whole nation's pikuach nefesh. However you look at it, it's hard to say that pikuach nefesh is not a consideration at all. That type, a definite sakana, somebody's going to take on a suicide mission, so then they would be exempt. It's just that the idea that it could threaten your life, so we know that that's an inherent part of Mochama. And so therefore you can't say that the threshold is going to be the same as Shmira Shabbos or kosher or other areas of halacha, where that type of sakana would get you off the hook. There is also a discussion, this is a nice discussion in Sefer Chavetzela Sasharon. It talks about the fact that we refer here to the Choshen Mishpat, but elsewhere in the Torah, earlier in this same parak and in Parshas Pekudei, So it's referred to only as the Choshet. And Nimukei HaRamban notes also that the Urim V'Sumim is not mentioned in other contexts in the Chumash, in the Maisa HaUbnim, with the craftsmen who were making the Mishkan, or in the section of Miluim. And he explains it's because this part was really a sod for Moshe, that only he was the one who made them, and he put them in after Aaron already had the Choshen on. So until then, it was just called the Choshen. And after that, then it's called, within the context of the Urim V'Tumim, it's called the Choshen HaMishpat. This is probably relevant to a Machlokas Rishonim, as he notes, that the Ravid argues in the Rambam, the Ravid Hilchos Beis HaBechira in Perek Dalet Halacha Aleph, the Ravid argues in the Rambam that if you're missing the Urim V'Tumim, that's not called Mechusar Begadim. You know that Kohen can't serve with any missing Begadim. So the Ravid says, missing the Urim V'Tumim is not called Mechusar Begadim, which therefore opens the question, what is the Urim V'Tumim? Is the Urim V'Tumim part of the Big Day Kahuna? Or is it there to serve a function? It's there to be consulted, but it's not actually a part of the Big Day Kahuna that would affect its status of being complete. There is a discussion in general, if you look in the Paris Yosef, and the more recent Sefer called Dvar Torah also talks about this a little bit, about the question of the usage, the consulting of the Urim V'Tumim, the Choshen HaMishpat, can that be done at times, for example, when there's no din? So is it treated like Choshen HaMishpat in the Shulchan Aruch sense? Is it treated like din? That we know that din doesn't take place at Laila, so that Baal HaTorah maintained that you don't consult the Urim V'Tumim at night either. And there's also a discussion, what about Shabbos? So we don't have Beis Din on Shabbos. We also maybe have a consideration of Kosev. Maybe this is somehow like Kosev. So there's a discussion about that in the poskim. For the most part, it's not so clear that that's an issue. It's not so clear that either one is necessarily an impediment. It sounds like, especially when it comes to Shabbos, it sounds like for the Gemara, they did consult it on Shabbos. If you look in the Paris Yosef, he considers possibly distinguishing between the Shabbos question and the Laila question. Okay, if it comes up with Maisa, we'll discuss it. Also in honor of Purim, so if you look at Pasuk Chaf, so when it's listing the stones, so one of the stones is Tarshish. So Tarshish, you may remember also, or you may notice it on Motzei Shabbos when it comes up in the first parak of the Megillah among the advisors of Haman, I mean the advisors of Achashverosh, and Achashverosh is trying to figure out what to do with Vashti. So the Gemara Maseches Megillah, Daf Yud Beis, comments on how all these names that are there are ramazim to different things in the Beis HaMikdash. And that the Malachim would kind of defend the Jewish people and say, look how the Jews, so they use all these things for their holy purposes, and what were they being used for in the time of Achashverosh? So in that context, so the Gemara picks up on that word, Tarshish, which appears there in the Megillah, and appears here. And the Gemara says, yeah, you see, did they use Tarshish the same way that the Jews did to serve with Big Day Kahuna in the Beis HaMikdash? That was a way of calling attention to that differentiation. And the Meshech Chachma has a little discussion over there where he takes that a little bit further, and he notes that Tarshish is the stone of Usher. And Usher, Chazal tell us, had daughters who were very fine, modest daughters who would marry into the Kahuna. And therefore, again, there's a contrast being established. Look how Vashti is being shown off first. They wanted to show her off in the most priestess-dick, immodest fashion. And contrast that with the nobility of the Jewish people, the daughters of Usher, who were treated in a much more dignified fashion, in an opposite fashion, and they were tznuos, and it kind of illustrates a little bit the difference that this Gemara is trying to make. The next pasuk goes on and talks about the names of the shvatim that are there on the stones. So it says, "Vavadim tiyana al shmos bnei Yisrael, shtei mesrei al shmosam." So as the Znaim Torah points out, that seems a little bit redundant, right? So names of the bnei Yisrael, and the 12 of them al shmosam. So we already know there's 12 of them. So he suggests it's a reference to the way the Rambam conceives things a little bit. That the Rambam has it that you have the 12 names on the 12 stones. But the first stone, Reuven stone, so it also says on top of it, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And then in the last stone, in Binyamin, it says Shiftei Kah. So you have all the letters of the alphabet so that you could be able to convey any message through the stones. So maybe you would think that Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, they're also there on the stones. So maybe it's not called after the Shvatim. Maybe it has a different characterization. So therefore, the Torah emphasizes it's still called after the Shvatim, despite the fact that the Avos are there also. There is a lot of discussion, to skip a little bit towards the end. So in terms of the Choshen and the Ephod, so the Pasuk says, so towards the end of the year in Chavches, that lo yizach ha-choshen me'al ha-eifod. So what does that word mean, lo yizach? So the choshen and the eifod should be connected all the time. It sounds like lo yizach means it shouldn't be separated. That's how Rashi translates it. It's more lashon nitzuk. So there is a whole discussion, there's a lot written about what this isser is about. The Rambam in Mishneh Torah says that one is only loke for this if he does it derech kilkul. But other Rishonim don't have that distinction. Let's figure out what that means, derech kilkul. But the other Rishonim, the Smag, and others don't have this chiluk, and even the Rambam in Sefer HaMitzvahs doesn't write this chiluk. So it's an interesting question whether or not it's true. Is there such a condition that the viser is only violated if it's derech kilkul? So some wanted to suggest that the Yismach Moshe writes that perhaps it was a suffik lahalacha, and therefore the Rambam writes in Mishneh Torah you only get malchus if you do it derech kilkul, because we're not sure that it's us or otherwise. But in Sefer HaMitzvahs he doesn't mention that distinction because he wasn't sure that it's true. So that said, it raises an interesting discussion. There is a sefer called Eish Tamid. It's written by Tamar Chacham, we've mentioned in the past, by Shlomo Sinneman. Has a whole discussion about this, about how does this factor into the Rambam's position about Sveika Deraisa L'Chumra, Sveika Derabbanan L'Kula, and the assumption that the Rambam generally holds that Min HaTorah Sveika L'Kula, that the din of Sveika Deraisa L'Chumra is itself a din Derabbanan, but there is a distinction to be made between Mitzvah Lo Sase and Mitzvah Sase. That in Mitzvah Sase, the Rambam would agree that a Safek one has to machmir and to do it. So here, one could also raise the possibility that it sounds like from the Targum Yonatan that maybe this is also manifested as a mitzvah saseh. That the Targum Yonatan has a lashon of lemeheve hadikin, that they should be connected to each other, not that you shouldn't take it off, but that they should be connected. So maybe it's a question whether we should view this more as a mitzvah saseh or as a lo saseh to separate them, which also affects the question. Do we limit the Esser to only if you do it derech kilkul, or is it a positive value that they should always be connected? Happens to be the Sefer Achinuch says this is only during the time of Avodah that it has to be connected. But in any event, the Darash Moshe and others, Moshe Feinstein and a few others, comment on the symbolism of this connection. That you have the Choshen and the Eifod. So the Gemara says that the Eifo, the Gemara in the middle of Maseches Erchin talks about the different Big Day Kahuna, Machaper for various things. And as the Netziv discusses in his commentary to Chumash, this is really kind of a secondary element to the Big Day Kahuna. The Big Day Kahuna had their primary roles, and the Gemara says also that they were Machaper for various things. So the Eifo is Machaper for Avodah Zarah, and the Choshen, Choshen HaMishpat is mechaper for mistakes in din, for having a messed up system when it comes to justice. So the connection between the two is a topic a lot of Mefarshim talk about. So Moshe Feinstein has a comment here, which I think is very much in the spirit of an observation we made, I think, here a little while ago. We've commented in the past. The Balatanya has a statement which I think is a little bit too harsh. The Balatanya says that even though we have mitzvos, and then we also have Ikari Amuna, that there are certain things which if you deny them is considered to be kfir. So the Baal Tanya says, really you should say that any Avera is kfir, because the person who commits an Avera is basically saying that God's not watching. So isn't that kfir? So it sounds a little bit overly harsh, because the fact that a person does something against their interest doesn't mean that they deny that it's going to have those consequences. So a person smokes, it's not because he necessarily denies that it's bad for him, it's because right now his desire to smoke outweighs his focus on the consequences. So too, a person eats treif, let's say, so it's not because he necessarily denies God is watching, it's because his desire for the treif food right now overwhelms his concern about the consequences. So in general, I wonder how compelling that point is, that any avera is really kfira. However, in the area of mamonos, there's a little bit more room to say that, because the whole reason you have to steal is because you believe it's going to benefit you. But if you think that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is working it out, who gets what, and everyone gets what they need, and everyone gets what they're meant to get, so then there isn't even any toelos to stealing. So in the area of Geneva, it's a little bit stronger, perhaps, to say that there is a bigger connection between Emuna and abstaining from Geneva. So it happens to be, Rav Moshe Feinstein makes this point exactly in his commentary to Chumash in Darash Moshe. Others note other things in the connection. Rebecca Kamenetsky, remember, nowadays you may not connect it to as much, but Rav Moshe and Rebecca were very closely affiliated with Rashi Yeshiva. And if you're my age, remember that they both were nifter in close proximity to each other. So their names are always right. So if you're born later, you may not be as acutely aware of this. But if you're older, you may remember that they died in close proximity to each other. So Rabbi Yaakov also comments differently on this issue, on the symbolic connection between the Choshen and the Ephod, based on their kapara. And he says that the one possibility is that Yashrus and Avodah Zarah are connected, in the sense that you should recognize that avoiding Avodah Zarah is simple Yashrus. And also that the Gemara says that Aaron was able to wear the Choshen because of the fact that he was happy for Moshe Rabbeinu. That's what the Gemara says in Masechet Shabbos. It's Daf Yomi around now, not so long ago, that because Aaron was happy for Moshe, didn't feel any jealousy, so that's why he was zocheh to wear the choshen. So too, the idea that nekiyas hamidos is what leads to yashrus in thinking, so to speak, that's perhaps all represented here. And mention a third view, there's Naim Lutora, or Muskarav, so he suggests that the connection between Avodah Zarah and Mamonos is to emphasize the Isser of our Kos, that we have a prohibition of going to non-Jewish courts, and sometimes in Chazal that's also emphasized as the fact that they are the courts of the Ovdei Avodah Zarah, and that by choosing to go to those courts, it's a way of really esteeming Avodah Zarah over the Jewish system. And therefore, perhaps here the Torah is connecting the two, Choshen Mishpat to Avodah Zarah, to say that your monetary issues should only be addressed through Choshen Mishpat, through the Jewish court system, and not in a way that esteems idolatry. Hi.
Could that also be true if it was a non-idolatrous, non-Jewish court?
It is true, Bahalacha, which I has always wondered why the Gemara emphasizes that so much. In general, if we're learning Mishpatim this week, or if we're learning Rishon Mishpatim, so you come back a year ago and 2 weeks ago, so we could talk about this in more detail, but it's interesting, it's clearly true in secular non-Jewish courts, and there's a lot to figure out why that is, because there, it's not an act of Avodah Zarah, it's actually a mitzvah. Right? Avodah Zarah is one of the Surim of Bnei Noach, but Din is the only mitzvah of Bnei Noach. So it's one thing to say that an idolatrous court, we don't want to give them any support in what they're doing, but a Beis HaMishpat of a Ben Noach system, that's really a mitzvah. So you have to understand a little bit more deeply why we have a problem with that. But this element that the Gemara does throw in, sometimes relevant, that you're giving esteem to idolatry instead of to God's Torah. So perhaps that's what the connection between the Ephod and the Choshen is meant to convey here. Without focusing on those reasons, Nassim Gishtetner and his Laharis Nassim on Chumash, so he suggests that the connection is just to emphasize that the Kohen Gadol has to always be thinking of the Jewish people, and that's a core element of his mentality. And that's also what we find really in the last two psukim of the Aliyah here also, so we find, first of all, the word Tamid comes up in both psukim, in Chavtes and in Lamed. Right, v'nos Aaron v'shmos b'nei Yisrael b'choshen mishpat alibo b'vo l'kodesh l'zikar l'fnei Hashem tamid, that he should have this on tamid as effective approach, and the Meshachach Marais, this is to say that it's Maratza even not B'Shas HaKrava, which he then goes on to note, could he justify wearing Shatnez in general? It's a whole discussion, it's a whole Machlokas HaRishonim, the Big Day Kahuna involved Shatnez, so it's Mutter clearly B'Shas HaVoda, is it Mutter even not B'Shas HaVoda? So here, in this context, the Kohen Gadol's Levush could be that even not B'Shas HaVoda, it's Maratza. And you find also that if you take this together with a pasuk in Rishon, where you also find a focus on the Avanim, on the Avnei Ha'ifod, so Rav Asher Weiss comments on this briefly in his drushes in the back of the Minchas Asher, where he notes that the idea is, we know the Kohen has a dual role, that the Kohen has to represent God to us and represent us to God. It's Machlokas in the Gemara, Pashtus is both. I think I've commented here that my father once told me that the name Kashdan, which is a last name people have, is often associated with Kohanim, and that the reason Kohanim have this name is because it's Rashi Tevis for either possibility. Kane Shluchei D'Rachmana Ninu, or Kane Shluchei D'Don Ninu, Chaf Shin Dalet Nun, spells out Kashdan. So the Kohanim represent in both directions. So we have the Avanim that represent our memory in front of God, so to speak, and the Choshen Mishpat to represent God's presence to us. In both directions, the Kohen has to serve that purpose. Okay, so just to look at the last pasuk in the Aliyah, where the Urim Tumim are emphasized here again, V'nasata el choshen ha-mishpat es-arim v'yasa-tumim v'hayu alev arim v'vol lifnei Hashem v'nasa arim es-mishpat b'nei Yisrael alibo lifnei Hashem tamid. So here you find tamid again, and the reference to the Urim Tumim. It's a little bit of discussion what the Urim Tumim were. Were the Urim Tumim the rocks, or were they the words, the letters on the racks? That's really somewhat of a involved discussion. But the phrase Urim V'Tumim, so the Gemara and the Yerushalmi, the Bavli and Yuma, and the Yerushalmi and Yuma comments, Urim brings light, and Tumim has some lashon of Tumimus. So the Bavli says that it's a Shlemus, that they are complete in their words, which sounds like it means actually they're irreversible. That's how some of the Mefarshim explain. And the Yerushalmi has more of a focus that if we are Tumim, so then it leads us properly. It tells us the way to go. And the Harish Nosson comments that perhaps this represents two aspects of the Kohen's responsibility, that he should be mayor, that he should say the right things, he should give the right mussar, and that he should act in such a way that is tamimistic and that carries it out, and that the Jews will be directed as follows. The Oznayim Mutara comments that you see here that there are two advantages the Urim V'Tumim has over a Navi. But even though a Navi is actually a higher Madrega than the Urim V'Tumim, but the Urim V'Tumim have two advantages. One is that a Navi might theoretically say something that may get reversed, and apparently the Urim V'Tumim don't. And also, Tamid, the Urim V'Tumim were available theoretically. If there was a need, they'd be available all the time. And the Navi wouldn't necessarily be available all the time.
What does it mean that Navi can say something and be reversed?
Well, in general, the rule is that if he gives a positive Nevuah, it doesn't get reversed. If he gives a negative Nevuah, so then if the people do tshuva, it can be reversed. That's how we generally understand. Why is that? The Rambam explains in Mar Nevuchim that we need to have something that doesn't get reversed, because the Torah tells us that you could have a false Navi, and the false Navi is going to be Chayiv Misa. So how are you going to know who's a false Navi? Somebody could always claim that he's telling the truth, but that circumstances change. So we need some way to evaluate that a Navi is the real deal. So if he prophesies something good and it doesn't happen, we know that he wasn't telling the truth. Because if he prophesies something bad, so we have to always have the possibility for tshuva. So we can't make that the test situation. So since tshuva exists, so it could be that a bad nevuah won't actually come true. But a good nevuah, that has to be consistent. But bad nevuahs can be undone. So apparently there is some reversibility for a Navi, but not for the Urim V'Tumim. That's how he suggests. There is also a symbolism again to the 12 stones representing all of the Jewish people. So Haris Nassim has a discussion about this as well, that it seems to be a reflection of the fact that we have different drachim on Avodas Hashem and we have to be able to respect all the different paths, and that this is similar to what the Magen Avraham quotes from the Ari, that there are 12 sharim of tefillah, 12 different gates of access through davening, and they represent the 12 different shvatim, which represents 12 different paths in Avodas Hashem. This idea of Ahayu Alei V'Aram, that the Gemara that we mentioned before, the Gemara in Shabbos, it's on the Kuf Lamed Tes, which says that the Tzchus of Aaron, the Samach Belibo, is why he has this on his lathe, why he has the Choshen Mishpat on his lathe. So the Maram Shik has a comment. Maram Shik was one of the great Talmidim Lichsam Sofer. So he understands the connection that if you're going to be the Kohen who's going to daven on behalf of Klal Yisrael, so you have to be someone who is able to really care about Klal Yisrael and identify without any kind of negius, that you care about the other person completely and totally. So since Aaron had this need, he didn't have any jealousy, so he was happy for Moshe. Didn't bother him that Moshe had something that he didn't. That ability to really connect to somebody's joys and sorrows without any intervening feeling, that's what it takes to be somebody who's going to daven on behalf of Klal Yisrael. And Sforno has a comment also on the word tamid, that he has to be able to daven all the time on behalf of the Jewish people, that things should work out for them. And later Sforno comment, there's a whole essay about this in a beautiful paper, Ish L'Re'ehu, which has a lot of discussions of midos you find in the Parsha. That so too, if he's going to daven on behalf of the people, he's got to be constantly thinking about their issues, constantly involved in their problems, and that's what it means to be the Kohen Gadol, to be able to feel that complete connection. Just to kind of connect that to Purim, and then maybe we'll say a few words about Zachar and a few words about drinking, because that was a requested topic. So but in terms of this point about Aaron being one who is able to connect totally with all the Jewish people, so we know that we find that we have a mitzvah of Shalach Manas, and last year we devoted some significant time to it, so this year we'll just speak very briefly about it. But the Din of Shalach Manas, one of the four mitzvahs that we have in the observance of Purim, there is a famous machlokas about what the purpose of Shalach Manas is. That the machlokas was made famous irrevocably by the Chassam Sofer. The Chassam Sofer had a tshuva where he popularized this machlokas, and since then, the past 200 years, it's been very, very carefully adhered to. Any discussion of Shalach Manas always invokes this machlokas. The way the Chassam Sofer presents it, that according to the Trumas Hadashin and his tshuvas, the purpose of Shalach Manas is to help out with the Suda, that people should be able to have what to eat. So we know that there's an obligation to have a Suda. People might not have enough. So therefore, in order to make sure people do have enough, so we should send food around. And the Manos HaLevi apparently said differently. The Manos HaLevi was written by Rav Shlomo Alkabetz. This is probably the second most famous thing he ever wrote. The most famous thing he ever wrote was L'cha Dodi, and this is a far second. I guess not as many people know about this as L'cha Dodi, but it's still probably a far second, the second most famous comment ever. That the reason we have Shalach Manas is because Haman, when he wanted to kill the Jews, so he said to Achashverosh, Yeshna Omecha, there is this one nation that is scattered and dispersed and they're all over the place, and we should kill them. So in order to counter what Haman said, so we want to connect the Jews to each other, even if we are geographically dispersed, so we still are able to connect. And the way we do that is through sending gifts. The fastest way to a man's heart is through the stomach. So we send gifts of food that will create a connection between people. So according to at least the Manos HaLevi, the purpose of Shalach Manas is really to create this achdus, is really to create this connection that people have with each other. And the truth is, both reasons point in that direction, because if you maintain, like the Trumas HaDeshen, that it's there to help with the Suda, so it's also an idea of taking other people's problems as their own and recognizing that even if you have a Suda, that's not enough if others around you don't. The reasons are also unified according to the Chalkas Asad, that was a contemporary of the Sram Sofer, Blazer Deutsch. He thought this whole machlokas was kind of overblown. He didn't really think there was really two different opinions. He thought that really everyone agrees with the Manos Halevi, that the point of Shalach Manos is really to make friends. It's just that the Trumas Hadeshin is saying that if you're going to send a gift, you might as well send a gift that is relevant to what somebody needs that time. So they have a suda that day, they have a chiyuv to make a suda, they may not have enough food, so therefore it's there to accomplish that purpose specifically, but it's the same thing as the Trumas Hadeshin. Hi.
Could there be a possible nachmina if, like, you have a choice between giving a lot to two people or a very small amount to 20?
It's interesting. There are a lot of nachminas that are talked about in that context. This is, again, it's just a fascinating sugya. We spent a lot of time on it last year, so I'm speaking a little more quickly about this year. But in general, you often find in many sugyas you have a chakir and you have nachminas. Here, it's fascinating how faithful the formula is. That the Chassam Sofer introduced this machlokas, he used it to explain a certain din in the Ramah, and then he gave another nafkamina, and then since then, every issue is somehow a nafkamina of this question. So if somebody asks you, should I use a blue basket or red basket for my Shalach Manos? Well, it's obviously told in Shum Sadesh, I'm not so lazy, that if it's about helping with the Suda, so blue baskets fit better on the table. And if it's about making friends, so red's more cheerful. You know, somehow everything is totally on this issue. So you're certainly welcome to draw that comparison. It's interesting, you don't find that written so much in that context. There is a major machlokas, which is a different topic. We can't discuss everything about Purim today, but it happens to come up in the context of Hilchos Matanos Levyon, and it's really a stuck a question in general, but it is invoked specifically in Hilchos Purim, the question of a person has tzedakah to give, and for some reason his wealth is finite. This person doesn't have infinite money, so he can only give out a certain amount of money. So how should he do it? Should he give it out in large gifts to fewer people? Or in smaller increments to more people? And here, it's machlokas in two ways. There are those who say better to make a bigger impact. The back of Emden, the Maharal maintained like that. And there were others who said better to give in smaller gifts. But even within that view, the smaller gifts, there's two ways to look at it. The Rambam writes famously in his commentary to the Mishnayos and Pirkei Avos that it's worthwhile to give smaller gifts because every time you're going to give a matana, it's going to have an impact on your neshama. Every time you're going to have to be generous, it's going to create a more generous soul. So he says this in the commentary to Pirkei Avos, because the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, Hakol lefi rov hamasa. Everything is evaluated, everything is assessed based on the multitude of the actions. That's how you translate rov in that context. So he says it's to contrast with Godel, Hakolafi. Godel on my seats, everything is based on the magnitude. So the question is, should you do something big, make a big splash, or do a lot of small things? So he says, better to do a lot of small things. And he gives this example of staka, because every time you do it, it'll have an impact on your neshama. If you have to write out 20 checks to staka, that's 20 acts of giving. And if you write out one check, so then even if a check is worth 20 times as much, it's still only one mice that's going to have less of an impact on you. Hi.
Really a college student, let's say.
General stucker questions about the obligations of a college student?
Yeah.
Right, so that's also a separate discussion. We'll see how much you can cover all these extra points, but we'll come back to that in a second. But it's just worth noting the Bach in Hilchos Purim. So the Bach says also that you should give out smaller gifts. But he comes from a completely different angle. The Bach says that it seems to him pashut and obvious that you should give out to more people rather than to one person. Because he says, Shabazah, Hichya, Yoser, Neshama, something like that, Yoser, Nefashos. That basically you're going to have a greater impact on more people. So essentially, it seems to be that's his economic theory, that the world is better off when more people are taken care of a little bit than fewer people are taken care of a lot. Right, so essentially there's a different focus between the Rambam and the Bach in terms of, we talk about in general when it comes to chinuch, so we have, when it comes to chesed rather, so we have chesed as something that we do for others, and we have chesed as something that we do for ourselves, that we should be more godlike. So usually they tell you the same thing. They both indicate that you should act the chesed, but sometimes they have differences, or they have different manifestations. So the Rambam is more focused here in this context on your own improvement, on your own spirituality. And the Bach is more focused on v'hafta recha kamocha, what will be more helpful to the world. Is there a difference, l'halacha, between the two? So there could be a couple differences. One difference would be, what if it's not your money? If you're the administrator of a fund, you didn't donate the money, you're just in charge of giving it out. So then presumably the Rambam's reason doesn't apply to you. You don't have a right to make the decisions based on what's going to give you a bigger spiritual high. But if the money is given by others, but you're doing it because you think you'll have a bigger impact this way, so that's a legitimate factor to use for your discretion. Another nafkamina would be, what if you want to give many gifts to the same person? So the Rambam's reason would still apply if you're giving many gifts to the same person. And the Bach would say probably that's a waste of time and just give it all in one shot. It's only valuable if you're going to give it to different people. In any event, so just the point in terms of responding to Ajin's comments, you find that conversation in the context of Matanis Lavyonim rather than Shalach Manas. Now it's interesting, according to the Trumas HaDeshen, Shalach Manas kind of is Matanis Lavyonim. They really kind of morph into each other. They're both mitzvah sot staka. It's just that Matanis Levyonim is done with money and Shalach Manas is done with food. And also Matanis Levyonim is done with more overt Evyonim, while Shalach Manas is done more in a concealed way for people who are less obviously needy. And there are some who suggest that Das Sofer, someone who presents the Chasam Sofer, has an Tshuva. It's a whole discussion why it is there's no bracha in Shalach Manas. So many different answers are suggested. Some say, based on the Rashba and the Shuvis, that any time it's a ben adam l'chavero, so we don't have a bracha because maybe the other person won't accept. That's what it sounds like you're saying. It's a question whether that makes a difference here or not. But the Das Sofer wanted to suggest that if you're going to make a bracha, you're going to have to identify the mitzvah. That's what a bracha usually does. And here, the whole point of Shalach Manas is that really Shalach Manas and Matanis Levyonim are two forms of the same mitzvah, and it's kind of meant to blur the distinction, that they're both about helping people, but Shalach Manas is meant to be done in a way that really is doing the same thing as Matanis Levyonim in a less obvious way, so we don't want to have a bracha that's going to force us to have to identify one way or another, which is an interesting perspective. So that's... It's interesting, Rabbi Nachum Zembo was a great, great Gaon, tremendous Eloi Talmud Chacham, who was killed in the Warsaw Ghetto, and along with the vast majority of his writings, 99% of what he wrote that we don't have anymore, but we have a little bit next year, so learn the first parak of Shabbos. So one sefer that we do have from Rabbi Nachum Zembo is on the first parak of Masechta Shabbos, if we have more from him than other things. But it's called Tosas Chaim. But there is a comment there by Shlomo Orman, quotes in one of his Sfarim, that from Menachem Zemba, that notes the Gemara Maseches Megillah has a discussion about what did the Jews do that they deserve to be destroyed, so to speak, or to be almost destroyed, that they had such a Safek Sakana in the time of Achashverosh. What did they do wrong? So the Gemara has two approaches. One approach is that they partook in the very inappropriate Suda of Achashverosh. And the other answer is that they looked like they were going to bow down to Avodah Zarah in terms of Haman's tzelem that he was wearing, so he forced everyone to bow down to him and look as if they were bowing to Avodah Zarah, so that was their problem. So Menachem Zemba commented that the two reasons that we have for Shalach Manas parallel those two ideas. That if the issue is that we partook of an inappropriate Suda, so then what's the appropriate kapara for that? The appropriate kapara is that we should have an appropriate Suda. So the Suda of Purim is meant to be the kapara for the Suda of Achashverosh, and Shalach Manas is an integral part of making sure that Suda can happen. But if the idea is that it's something related to Avodah Zarah, so the Medrash says in Parshas Tzav that Gadol HaShalom, Shalom is a wonderful thing, that Bizman Shehein B'Chabur Achas, that when the Jews form one entity, one group. So then HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Afilu avdu avarazara ani mochalem. Even if they were engaged in idolatry, I'll still forgive them. So the kapara for avarazara is achdus, is creating this one unit, this interconnectedness. So shalachmanis is perhaps meant to evoke that. We only have a few more minutes, just to very quickly say one thing about Zachar that connects to last week's Parsha, and then maybe very quickly throw in some drinking in the discussion sense. So the last week we mentioned that the idea of the Kruvim facing each other and showing respect, we discussed a little bit how some of the Mefarshim, I think we mentioned by Simon has an essay about this in his Sefer, about the idea that the Kruvim face each other out of respect, that the Mishnah says you have two people who are together and there's no Divrei Torah between them, it's called a Moshav Leitzim. And if there is Divrei Torah between them, then we say Az Nibru Yuri Hashem and the Shechina is there also. So the difference between the two is both cases there's learning going on. But in the first model, they don't respect what the other has to say. They're not interested in each other's opinion. So that's called a Moshav Leitzim. Moshav Leitzim, we translate nowadays as clown, but really it means something a little different. And that's very relevant because the Medrash identifies Amalek as a letz. So that's a funny thing to say in both senses of the word, right? That if we translate Leitzanus as joking around and a letz as a clown, so Amalek doesn't seem to be like such a clown, despite the fact that many people have a history of being afraid of clowns. But other than that, if you're going to try to paint the picture of Amalek, try to depict him in some way, a clown would not be what comes to mind. So Rav Huttner discusses this in a very important essay in the first Maimer in Pachad Yitzchak in Purim, where he comments that the definition of letz is not really joking and clowning, but it means to be a cynic, it means to scoff, to not take other people seriously, to think people aren't important, nothing is important. That's the quality of a cynic, of a letz. And that Amalek was like that because Amalek's whole approach was to say that the Jews are not so formidable. And we know Chazal compared the whole attack to somebody who jumped into a burning bathtub. And everyone else is afraid to go into the hot bathtub until one person jumps in and says it's not so bad, now other people can do it too. So Amalek was basically saying, those Jews are not so scary, they're not so formidable, anyone can take them on. So that knocking down of Chashivas, that's what Amalek is all about. In the past, as commented, that the idea of a sense of humor has many milas to it in terms of Avodas Hashem. One major mila that it has, in a hashkafic sense, is that the ability to have a sense of perspective, to know what's a big deal and what's not a big deal, is crucial so that you can appreciate what is a big deal. So if you want to be able to appreciate the Torah, so you have to be able to distinguish between unimportant things and important things. But at the same time, if you go too far, if you become a cynic, you think nothing's important. So clearly, that's the opposite of what we're trying to accomplish. So we are looking for a sense of humor that's the right balance. We have the sense of balance and perspective so we can esteem that which is important. And clearly, you don't want to go over to the other end where you think nothing is important. It's not good if you think everything is too serious, but it's not good if you think nothing is serious. You have to be able to appreciate what is serious and what isn't. And that's the value of a sense of humor. So perhaps it's especially helpful to us that we have Purim in order to help us develop our Jewish sense of humor. But before we do that, we always have a Shabbos Zachar to remember Amalek. Remember how you can also go too far. You can go into cynicism, and that's not what we're trying to do. And especially in a year like this, where it's literally back-to-back, you have Shabbos Zachar, and you go immediately from that into Purim. Purim's mostly Shabbos, so we're able to kind of buttress the experience in our developing a sense of humor with this component of... with this element of awareness of what it means to be a cynic. So in terms of balance, it's important also then to just briefly address this issue of drinking. So I'll shoot right to the end. I think that if one wants to minimize the role of drinking in his life, even on Purim, so there is definitely what to support and to encourage that approach. As we know, especially in our dor, there is a lot of disaster and a lot of sorrow and problems that come out of drinking. And it's important to be aware of that, especially younger ages and especially older people who are viewed by younger people should be especially aware of the impact that alcohol and its abuse can bring about. And Purim should not be a time to abuse alcohol or to lose control. And I'll say this despite the fact that the Gemara says, Chai Ben Shlub Bsumi Bapuria Adol Yada Bein Baruch Mordechai Lo Aruch Haman. So the Gemara does have this statement that one is obligated to spice oneself up, however you want to translate that, Adol Yada. So how do we reconcile that with what I just said? So a couple of ways. First of all, so it's worth noting that there is an opinion in the Rishonim that we don't actually paskin like this opinion. That the Gemara tells a story right after it says that, and that Zion and Megillah, the Gemara tells a story about Rav and Rav Zera. Everyone knows the story, that Rav and Rav Zera had the Suda together, and Rav shechted Rav Zera after drinking, and he was able to bring him back through Tefillah. The Marsha kind of takes some of the excitement out of the story a little bit and says he wasn't dead, but that he was just sick and he davened for him to get better. Whatever it was, so Rav Zera got better. And then the Gemara says, the next year, Rav tried to invite him again, and Rav Zera said, it's okay. Lav Kol Shas says, Charish Nisa, I can't rely on a miracle happening every year. I'll skip it this time. So the Rabbeinu Ephraim writes that this is just a more dramatic way of what you sometimes find in the Gemara, where the Gemara will say, here's a din. And the next line will say, no, that's actually not the din. So the way it says here, that's actually not the din, is by saying, actually, that led to one of the great Gedolei HaTalmud being shechted, which you can kind of infer that it wasn't necessarily such a successful plan. So that's a question how to read that. The Prichadash notes, if that was really the case, they got rid of it, so then how come we didn't want to come the next year? So, I don't know if that's necessarily an unworkable kasha, but Chassam Sofer in his tshuva about Shalach Manas, they mentioned before, Kuf Tzadi Vav in Aruch Chaim. In the end of the tshuva, he discusses that Prichadash a little bit. He has a creative approach. You can take a look. But that's one possibility, that it's not a Libet HaHelchasa. Another possibility others mention is that even if it is a remaining statement, still it's not necessarily a Chiyuv. That's another possibility. A third possibility to be aware of, this is related to Shmuel Salant's Chakira that David was alluding to before, is that Adol Yada doesn't mean that you're supposed to reach that stage. It means that if you do reach that stage, you've gone too far. There was a whole discussion, I believe, of Shmuel Salant's comment. It was invoked in the context also of comparing it to a person as an Avelos. They say he's supposed to grow his hair, Ad Sheyigar Bo Chavero. So what does that mean? It means that once his friend says you're disgusting, so then he's accomplished something? Or does it mean, no, that if it happens, he's gone too far? So it's a way of saying that you shouldn't actually be at that point. If it happens, then pull back. So Adol Yada means you should reach a goal of Adol Yada, or does it mean that's too far, that's too much? That's also something to keep in mind. In any event, the Ramah writes that one fulfills Adol Yada by drinking a little more than he's used to, and then you take a nap, so when you're sleeping, so you don't know the difference between Aruch Haman and Baruch Mordechai. You could also maintain, to say a little bit of Chiddush in the Ramah, that when you're sleeping and you have a dream, so even if you would dream about Aruch Haman and Baruch Mordechai, so the way dreams work, it'll probably be Haman will be playing Mordechai's part, Mordechai will be playing Haman's part, so they'll be confused with each other, so a dream, your dreaming state is also a kiyum in Adol Yada. So that's another element to keep in mind. And beyond that, it's also brought down in the Mishnah Berurah and others that if being in this state is going to keep you even, let's say, from benching, so then that's not justifiable. It's not an excuse not to bench. And certainly other mitzvahs and other obligations of decency, ben adam l'chaveru, ben adam l'makom, if a person is going to be compromised in any of these areas because of the drinking, so there is no license to do that. And certainly, 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 if somebody is going to be driving or anything like that, nobody ever suggested that this is Yehari Val Yavor. Nobody ever suggested that one should put his own life and others' lives at risk in order to fulfill this concept of Chalila. So it's pretty clear that if that's under consideration, so certainly, certainly no head to drink it in a way that's going to put anyone at risk of any danger.
I understand the limits of the chiyuv to Adol Yada, saying that it's a lot of the chal, or even that getting to that point is not Makiv on the Suda, but the Lashon of the Gemara is a Chayiv in the Sume. So
correct, so still the Ma'aril read it a little bit differently, and take all these points together, there's definitely enough to rely on in the current climate where Nebuchadnezzar, especially now, because you know, once upon a time people didn't drive, you didn't have the ability to do as much damage in an intoxicated state as maybe we did historically. And it's really a tremendous machlo what you see happening today, with people with teenagers drinking and with too much of a mystique put on the whole drinking experience. It's reasons to consider acting a little bit differently. So I think that Sira, for all those opinions, you know, at most, the most drinking is the Ramah. Drink a little bit more and take a nap. So that's if you want to go that far. If you don't even want to go that far, there is what to rely on for other any other question.
I've heard mentioned that the people say that the state of drinking is only connected to the studas that found in Rishon.
Yes, that's also what I want to mention. Also, that it sounds like from the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, just an additional point that also should be pointed out, is that it seems to only be connected to the Suda, so any drinking outside of the Suda is not necessarily akim in anything. And we assume l'halacha against the Ravya, but the vast majority of the Rishonim maintain that the Suda is only during the daytime. So any drinking that you see taking place at night is b'taras einam mitzuviosa. It's really not according to almost any opinion. Again, the Rav Yah maintained the Zechiyah Suda at night. There were those who argued that even within the Rav Yah, that he would not necessarily assume that Chayv Inish is a part of it at night. So that it's, even according to him, it could be it's only a part of the Suda during the daytime. So to drink at night, there really doesn't seem to be any justification whatsoever, even without all this. And then during the daytime, that's what we've discussed the past few minutes. So also note that it sounds like from Rashi that the whole concept only works with wine, and that other intoxicating things are not fulfillment. Others disagreed, but that's also a limitation to keep in mind.
Also, this is maybe also a broader question. If you're planning on attending multiple sudas, and let's say you decide to hold like the Rama, would it be, you only need to do it at one, I assume?
Presumably, there's a little bit of a discussion, you know, from a Lamdish perspective is what Claire about that, but again, I certainly think you would be yotze with it happening once. It gets a little bit into the Claire that David was raising about what does ad lo yada mean. So the lamdish way to put it is a shir kiyum or shir p'tur, you know, you accomplish it and then you're done, or is it a shir p'tur, which is a way of saying you've gone too far, that if that happens, you're p'tur, but then until that happens, you keep going. Maybe that's a little bit of a lamdish discussion. But again, certainly certainly enough to rely on that one Ramah fulfillment today should certainly be enough. All right, so we'll stop there. God willing, tomorrow, we'll see you all at the business.